From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, reaction to President Obama's State of the Union address. A women's group attempts to do its part for Syrian refugees.
It's the worst humanitarian tragedy in modern history.
Governments using blasphemy laws against online communications. And activists considering suspending the interview balloon launch into North Korea. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. In post-speech analysis, major news organizations agree that President Obama's seventh State of the Union address to Congress has set the policy agenda for the final 2 years of his presidency. The president called for enactment of a so-called middle-class economic plan, including affordable child care, free community college tuition, equal pay for women, and paid sick and maternity leave. On the foreign policy front, he called on Congress to give him trade promotion authority, a resolution authorizing the use of force against the Islamic State group, and legislation to confront the evolving threat of cyber attacks. President Obama also said it's time to turn the page.
We are 15 years into this new century. 15 years that dawned with terror touching our shores, that unfolded with a new generation fighting two long and costly wars, that saw a vicious recession spread across our nation and the world. But tonight, we turn the page. Tonight, after a breakthrough year for America, our economy is growing and creating jobs at the fastest pace since 1999.
Jeffrey Skelling, associate editor of the Larry Sabato Crystal Ball website at the University of Virginia Center for Politics, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the speech was one of Mr. Obama's best in terms of rhetoric and tone.
The fact that he has no other campaigns to run for, as he mentioned in the speech, and the fact that he's completely opposed in Congress now, is I think he felt like he had nothing to lose, and his speech somewhat reflected that.
Was this about a lot of small domestic items that the world really doesn't pay attention to?
Yes, I think, you know, he opens on the domestic front, and I think he did that for an obvious reason. That's because the domestic front's looking stronger for it. While I think some people are overreacting a bit to recent approval ratings for him, there's no question that, on the whole, his approval rating average has ticked up, and I think an improved economy has to play an important role in that. So you could say, to a certain extent, he was spiking the football on the fact that the economy has improved and created more jobs since any year since the late 90s. He was focusing on the positives.
In this era of soaring deficits, do you think these proposals will go anywhere?
In a larger sense, I think what Obama did tonight in terms of the domestic policy proposals is that he wanted to put forth a very aggressive kind of counterplan to what he expects Republicans to propose in order to perhaps create more space to accomplish things that he actually wants to accomplish in some kind of final budget agreement. Obviously, Republicans are not going to very easily agree to higher taxes, but at the end of the day, it does sound like, it's from Joni Ernst's response, that there might be some room in the tax area for some agreement as well as on trade.
What stood out on the foreign policy front?
I think a lot of critics are going to talk about the way the president addressed what has gone on in the Middle East. I think a lot of people are going to say that his description of what has happened in terms of the administration's approach to Islamic State, I think a lot of people are going to criticize the president and the administration handled it. I thought it was notable that he told Congress that he thought it would be great if they would start the process of ending the embargo against Cuba. I think he actually will, you know, get some response on that and some positive response. There seems to be a mixed bag of opinions on that front.
Was he staking out, and were the Republicans staking out positions that they'll take in the 2016 election?
I do think that many of the things that the president brought up tonight in his speech are going to be issues that someone like Hillary Clinton or whoever the Democrats end up nominating are going to pursue. The president is in a position to influence that, and I think there are issues that the Democratic base wants, and those are going to be issues that Democratic candidates are going to be mostly inclined to agree with. Considering where the president is positioned right now in terms of his approval rating, kind of in the mid-40s, someone like Hillary Clinton, if she does run, will be picking out spots to agree with the president on. I think there are a lot of proposals he laid out tonight that she may run on, particularly something like maternity leave. those are the issues where you'll see Democratic candidates running toward the president and not away from him.
Skelling says there is no doubt partisan rancor will dominate the final 2 years of Mr. Obama's presidency, but he believes there is room for agreement on tax reform, cyber terrorism, and trade. He says free of further elections, Mr. Obama will use the platform or bully pulpit of the presidency to push hard for his legislative priorities.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
Syrian refugees are enduring blizzard conditions, including severe winds and freezing rain, as the worst winter in decades envelops the Middle East. For many, this is the fourth winter without adequate shelter from the biting cold. Millions of Syrians displaced from their homes by fighting are vulnerable, along with refugees in several neighboring countries. The numbers have overwhelmed the limited capacity of the international community to alleviate the suffering. A few small agencies are trying to help, though it is far from enough. Reporter Mohammed El-Shenawi spoke with the president of the National Syrian Women's Association, Farah Atassi, about the contribution her group is making.
The organization was formed in 2012. Our main focus when we were formed was to address the humanitarian issue in Syria. Right now, the organization expanded its goals and initiatives, so we're mainly focusing on three main criteria. Number one is to help Syrian women and children, of course, who are the main victims in this conflict. 75% of the refugees in Turkey and Jordan and in Lebanon are women and children. Second is women empowerment, because since the beginning of the Syrian revolution, women were on the forefront at the peaceful demonstration. They were on the media, on every front. Unfortunately, because of the security issue, the role of the women in this ongoing conflict somehow marginalized. So we're trying here to empower women through pushing for more women political participation in main Syrian opposition groups. Of course, women are very active in the civil society work and NGOs. They do a lot of work in case of working with these raped women, of helping women find jobs and creating some sort of small business opportunities for women outside the refugee camps in Jordan. To create a group of women that sew certain clothes and they sell it for the Jordanian market or outside. And the third dimension is the media because unfortunately right now who is speaking on behalf of the Syrian revolution and explaining the situation in Syria are mainly not the real civil society of Syria. There are a lot of violence. There are a lot of fanatism over there. So women always are the messengers of peace. Women are the messengers of tolerance and coexistence. So we're trying to have women more as agent of change and promoting reconciliation, dialogue between the fragmented Syrian society. And the last thing we are trying to help the wives of the Free Syrian Army who defected from the Syrian regimes. These women were isolated, neglected. Really, nobody knocked their doors. Their husbands risked their lives to defect from the Syrian regime and go fight and defend the Syrian revolution, whereas these women live in danger, live in a very poor condition. We're trying somehow to help this woman financially, also creating jobs and taking care of them.
What's your assessment of the current situation in Syrian displaced and refugee camps, especially in the severe cold weather?
It's like what Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said, it's the worst humanitarian tragedy in modern history. I can't really summarize in few words the tragedy that the Syrian people has to face on daily basis. We lost so far around 17 women and children and two elderly in Jordan and in Lebanon and also in northern Aleppo because of the cold weather. Those people, they don't have adequate access to food, to medicine, to clothes. Unfortunately, there is difficulties in distributing the international aid and the food and the supplies into the areas inside Syria. The refugees in Lebanon and in Jordan, the Syrian local committees, the Syrian coalition and the Syrian interim government and also the government of these countries took some procedures to deal with this wave of cold that hit that area. But unfortunately, the people inside Syria, they don't have that hand to help them. A lot of them are displaced. A lot of them, their tent fell on the whole family. Again, we're trying to move these people to a proper areas. We managed to help a few families and children and people to move them to some schools, and that's just a temporary solution. Definitely, we need more help. There should be a serious international effort to end the Syrian crisis, and I always say that what we're doing right now is like giving a painkiller to somebody who's diagnosed with cancer. What we're doing like now is easing the pain of the Syrian people, not taking care of that pain permanently. So what we need to do is to deal with the source of the problem. Why these huge numbers of refugees outside Syria? Why there is 6.7 internally displaced Syrians inside Syria? Because there is an ongoing conflict, because there is one man refusing to step down and allow for political reconciliation and political solution. So we call for the U.S. government and for the Friends of Syria to meet again and to evaluate the current situation with all the threats that Syria face inside and outside Syria, to take actual steps into ending the source of problem by forcing Assad, not inviting Assad, by forcing Assad into giving a political concession or work toward political settlement.
Farah Tassi, president of the National Syrian Women's Association. The pair of shootings at the satiric publication Charlie Hebdo have reignited debate about the limits of speech, particularly when it comes to blasphemy or speech that some deem insulting to a religion or sacred symbol. But that is not stopping dozens of governments around the world, most notably in majority Muslim nations, from using anti-blasphemy laws to aggressively punish alleged transgressions, especially against Islam. In the past, blasphemy charges were most often brought against people for something they said in public. But these days, governments are increasingly turning their attention to what people say and do while online. Our cyber correspondent, Doug Bernard, spoke with us about the issue.
By most estimates, about 22% of the world's nations have blasphemy laws on the books, and no region of the globe is immune. You can find them in Asia, for example, India and Indonesia. You can find them in Africa, in Europe, in the Americas. By the way, there's even a few U.S. states, like Michigan, for example, that have anti-blasphemy laws still in effect, although the U.S. never has and does not. Now, that said, the greatest concentration is in the Middle East and North Africa. A full 70% of the nations there have laws that criminalize blasphemy on the books, and increasingly they're using them. And I think therein lies another significant difference. It may be one thing to say Germany and Italy still technically have these laws, but prosecutors aren't using them, and they haven't used them for many years. In fact, most nations don't routinely use them, but a few do, and those few are becoming more aggressive in applying them.
So who are these nations?
Well, the most aggressive governments would include Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, Indonesia, and Iran, but other nations present problems as well. And nearly all of these nations are increasingly turning to the Internet to monitor what people say and do. So let's take a recent case in Saudi Arabia, just as an example. A few years back, 30-year-old blogger and Saudi citizen named Raif Badawi founded a blog called Free Saudi Liberals. He wanted to foster discussion about religion and Saudi figures. In 2012, he was arrested for insulting Islam on his blog and committing apostasy. That charge was later dropped, but he was convicted on the first charge, lost on his appeal, and he's now serving a sentence of 10 years in prison and 1,000 lashes to be meted out, 50 each week for 20 weeks. Now, as evidence of blasphemy, prosecutors pointed to one post on his blog in which Badawi criticized the leadership of a prominent university. Now, that may have angered the leadership there, but there was nothing inherently insulting to Islam in there. And another bit of evidence they used was a comment that someone else had left on his blog, but authorities said he didn't write it. They agree, but he didn't take it down fast enough. Just as a side note, the U.S. State Department, Amnesty International, other groups have called on Saudi Arabia to stop his punishment, quash his sentence, but so far the government there has not budged.
Why are the authorities there focused on the internet so much in these prosecutions?
Well, I think in a word, because it's easy. Of course, you can always try and delete things online, but that can be very difficult, and especially in countries like Saudi Arabia that keep a very close eye on what people are saying and where they're going while they're online. So it's a very quick process for a prosecutor to just scan through everything that you've said or done and then use that potentially as evidence at trial. That said, I think there may be another more complex reason. Several analysts we spoke with have noted that often in the nations that are pursuing these types of blasphemy charges, they also tend to be places where there's really not much free expression, particularly any criticism of those in power. So in a place like Saudi Arabia, where there are such deep and close connections between the royal family and religious leadership, criticizing or even just raising questions can easily be seen as a challenge to all of the authority. So in the end, perhaps it's really no surprise that is the use of social media and the internet have grown, especially as we saw after the Arab Spring, people becoming more comfortable in expressing their views online. Governments there are turning to blasphemy laws to punish people for what they say while they're on the internet.
Well, thank you, Doug, for stopping by and sharing all this with us.
Happy to be here.
VOA cyber correspondent Doug Bernard here in our Washington studios. A North Korean defector group says it is willing to suspend plans to send balloons into North Korea carrying DVD copies of The Interview, a fictional movie depicting the assassination of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. VOA's Brian Patton reports.
Park Sung-hak, a North Korean defector living in South Korea and leader of an activist group called Fighters for Free North Korea, says his organization this week sent balloons full of thousands of leaflets that were critical of the Pyongyang government into the North. But he says they did not send copies of the movie The Interview, an American fictional comedy that mockingly portrays then kills off the North Korean leader.
정부 차원에서 당분간만이라도.
He says the South Korean government asked them to refrain from sending the USBs and DVDs for a while, so they went along with that request. The United States has accused North Korea of orchestrating a cyber attack on Sony Pictures in December to prevent the release of The Interview and has imposed new sanctions against top North Korean officials. Pyongyang denied allegations of hacking, but has called the movie an act of war. South Korea has reached out recently to the North to engage in talks to organize reunions for families that have been separated since the end of the Korean War in 1953. But Pyongyang has said in the past that these balloon launches of anti-regime materials must first be halted before they will enter into any dialogue. Seoul has refused to stop the balloon launches, citing freedom of speech issues, but did appeal to the organizers to show restraint. Park Sung-hak says his group will wait until February 18th, which is Lunar New Year's Day. He says if North Korea does not respond to the government's proposals, such as the reunion of separated families and the holding of talks, they will send a huge number of USBs and DVDs of the movie The Interview, which he says will destroy Kim Jong-un. Thor Halvorsen with the Human Rights Foundation, a U.S.-based group that supports the balloon launches, says while they will refrain from sending The Interview movie for now, they will continue to send other anti-regime leaflets.
The North Korean government threatens with guns. It threatens with knives. It threatens with missiles. All we have is ideas.
Some South Korean residents living near the border have expressed concern that these balloon launches could prompt North Korea to attack their towns and villages. And a balloon launch last year sparked an exchange of gunfire between North and South Korean soldiers at the border. Brian Patton, VOA News, Seoul.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On January 21st, 1535, French Protestants were burned at the stake in front of the Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris. The executions came as the result of the so-called Placard Affair, in which Protestants displayed posters attacking Roman Catholic beliefs and practices. In 1793, King Louis XVI of France was executed on charges of treason in the midst of the French Revolution. Louis was accused of seeking foreign help to maintain an absolute monarchy in France. On this day in 1861, Jefferson Davis of Mississippi was one of five men who resigned from the U.S. Senate over concern about government threats to the rights of southern states, especially the right to maintain slavery. Davis later became president of the rebel Confederate States of America during the Civil War. In 1950, U.S. State Department official Alger Hiss was convicted of perjury in a case stemming from accusations that he had spied for the Soviet Union. On this day in 1987, Aretha Franklin was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Her 1967 cover of Otis Redding's Respect became her signature song. What you want? Dubbed the Queen of Soul by her generation, Aretha Franklin was number 9 on the Rolling Stone magazine list of the 100 greatest musical artists of all time. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
When President Barack Obama strode into the chamber of the U.S. House of Representatives last evening to report to assembled lawmakers, diplomats, and other distinguished guests on conditions in our country, he was following in the footsteps of other presidents who have used an occasion required by our Constitution in an effort to make history. Since President George Washington addressed the first Congress in 1790, all chief executives since then have followed his lead, and what began as a message between one branch of government to another has become a widely anticipated communication between the president and the people of both America and the world. Over time, radio and television coverage have increased the audience enormously. Now, President Obama is turning to social media, such as Facebook and Twitter, to reach a broader listenership of younger, digitally connected Americans for what is expected to be his most important speech of the year. Even presidents facing a Congress dominated by members of the other political party, as President Obama does now, have used the occasion to announce and promote significant new policies. President James Monroe, for example, crafted his 1823 State of the Union address to lay out a warning to the nations of Europe against interfering in the affairs of the Americas, the Monroe Doctrine. Abraham Lincoln told the nation in 1862 that he wanted to end slavery. And in 1941, Franklin Roosevelt laid out the four fundamental liberties that people everywhere in the world should enjoy: freedom of speech and of worship, freedom from want, and freedom from fear. On a certain level, however, the speech transcends politics and statecraft. The Constitution's framers devised the address to promote transparency and accountability in government. Because the president has access to the most information on the complex workings of government, he is required to give a comprehensive assessment of the overall state of the nation and our relations with the world. It also speaks to the separation of powers in our government, in that while the president uses the address to propose new programs and initiatives, it is Congress that decides how to proceed. And ultimately, both branches are accountable to the speech's larger audience, the American people.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.